everyone. This is The Big Fight, and I'm Maria Shakir. Donald J. Trump has won the presidency, improving upon his earlier performance in both red and blue states and capturing enough swing states to cross 270 electoral college votes. Millions of votes are still being counted, especially in western states, where tabulation is expected to take days or weeks to complete. World leaders have congratulated Donald Trump, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, Russian President Vladimir Putin, Ukrainian Premier Zelensky wasn't far behind. Reactions from world leaders are mixed. Vladimir Putin has expressed willingness to work with Donald Trump, emphasizing cooperation between Russia and the US. Meanwhile, the European Union and other international organizations are watching closely and are concerned about potential shifts in global dynamics. Trump's victory has significant domestic implications. He has pledged to strengthen the US border, prioritizing mass deportation and border security. The White House has rejected claims that the Democratic Party abandoned the working class, citing job creation and union support. As Trump prepares to take office, questions remain about the future of the world order. Will Trump's nationalism lead to increased global tensions or cooperation? How will his policies impact international trade and relations? The world watches with bated breath as the Trump administration begins to take shape. The question really is, how will his policies impact the world and what will be the implications of his presidency? We'll try and decode that on The Big Fight tonight. We have Syed Akbaruddin, former representative of India to the UN in Geneva. We have Michael joining me who is from Kyiv. He's a global affairs analyst, senior fellow at Atlantic Council. Pastor Mark Burns is spiritual advisor to President Trump. Ishan Tharoor is global affairs columnist of Washington Post. We have Daniel Block, senior editor of foreign affairs. Lakshya Jain is a co-founder of Split Ticket. We'll be joined by Kenny Chiu, who is a former conservative MP. In fact, he joins us from Canada, and Lisa Curtis, director of Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And Dr. Sebastian Gorka is a former deputy assistant to the President of the United States. I'm going to begin with the India perspective, and who better to speak to about that is Syed Akbaruddin. Sir, the question is Donald Trump good for India in his new term? Because right now he's speaking about America first.
So, Maria, whenever there is a change in administration in the U.S., the globe re-engages with the U.S. because it's a global power. From an Indian perspective, what we can say is that this sort of re-engagement is not new for India. We've seen many administrations change, and the Indian diplomatic establishment has the wherewithal to navigate these transitions with relative success. And even in the last 10 years of Prime Minister Modi's government, we've seen this is going to be the third president who they're going to deal with. In fact, fourth, because there was President Obama, President Trump in his first avatar, President Biden, and then President Trump in his second avatar. So the Indian diplomatic establishment has successfully navigated these and has, if you look at it, the trajectory of trials has improved on a consistent and secular basis. So I wouldn't think, if you look at the big picture, there shouldn't be a problem in navigating these. Given that it's President Trump, there are some uncertainties which we all need to be knowledgeable about and need to take into account. And these are not new. These are trends which we noticed in his last administration, and they're likely to be accentuated in the second administration. So what are these? These are, number one, greater access on tariffs. Hmm. Now, big countries like India have the ability to give and take in diplomacy, and they can navigate it. But Given that it's a Trump administration, there will be uncertainties, unpredictability. Also, given that India doesn't have a trade agreement with the US, it is possible that the fluctuations will be higher. So that's one area of tariffs and trade. Another area, perhaps from an Indian perspective, could be migration. We don't know what are the contours of President Trump's migration approach. While he has said it will target illegal migration, but we have seen in the last term that even regular, steady, predictable migration was affected in terms of H-1B visas and other types of visas. So it's a possibility that given the uncertainty, there could be an impact on migration. A third issue will be possibility that of uncertainty again in terms of areas of cooperation through multilateral arrangements or minilateral arrangements. While, yes, President Trump was the one who revived the Quad, generally he is averse to alliances and arrangements of a nature which are large. So we will have to look at it, but I don't think there is anything from an Indian perspective that we need to be worried about because the Indian diplomatic establishment and US converge in interests. And that's perhaps the most important thing. Once there's the convergence of interests, it will perhaps help you to tide over issues. One last thing in terms of President Trump, which perhaps is slightly better from an Indian perspective than the present administration is, that President Trump is not one to focus too much on values. Now, when Eastern and Western societies engage, it's normal that our perspectives will vary and it will be imbued by divergence in terms of values. That's not something that Trump would emphasize on given his past record. So I would think there would be less glitches on that front, more on interests, and there is a convergence of interests. So I see the ties only increasing rather than diminishing.
Okay. You know, when there was the transition which happened from Donald Trump to Joe Biden, there was a lot of skepticism, particularly what we had seen was a personal bonhomie and great personality-driven foreign policy between Prime Minister Modi and Donald Trump. Right now, again, it's the return of Donald Trump. But the question, as you said, is, Ambassador, that this is a new avatar of Donald Trump. We really do not know the new avatar. What does it mean? But there has always been that Trumponomics, which has been very pro-India or transactional in nature, which worked during the first 4 years.
Yes, you're right. President Trump's foreign policy is much more individual-driven and personalized in terms of engagement with global leaders. But then I think given the track record and what President Trump himself has repeatedly said, that he regards Prime Minister Modi as a friend, he regards him as a strong leader, he regards the ties with India as a priority. It's not a challenge for countries like India because I think we are in a good spot there, given the personal chemistry between the two leaders. And India as a country should not be wary of that, but there may be others who would have a challenge. I don't see that again as a factor that could impede the growth of Indo-US ties in the second Trump administration. But that said, the caveat always is unpredictability of President Trump, although he hopefully has mellowed, matured during the last 4 years. And we hope that some of these creases are ironed out.
My last question to you, you know, most analysts and watchers of Donald Trump say, do not take Trump at face value. What are your thoughts?
So you're right. And I would agree with that. Having said that, I would also say we need to watch what he does rather than what he says. Usually most of us go by what is said. And President Trump is known to say things that many of us find difficult to digest. But what he does is perhaps more calibrated. And we've seen that in the last term also. We've seen that in the course of this campaign. And we hope that we need to be, as countries, we need to focus on our interests. We need to focus on what the U.S. under Trump does, rather than to be carried away either way on what is rhetoric. There is a difference in that. And I'm certain Indian diplomats and decision makers are used to that. They know what to listen to and what to look the other way when they are not comfortable with some of these things.
All right, Ambassador Akbaruddin, thank you for your perspective and thoughts on the big fight tonight. Let me bring in other guests now and bring in Pastor Mark Burns. You know, you are the spiritual advisor to Donald Trump. And it's being said that this is a new avatar of Donald Trump. What is it that we should be prepared to look at? Pastor, if you heard me. Okay, we'll try and connect with him in just a bit. But let me bring in Daniel Block. Daniel, the question really is about how the world is trying to understand what this new Donald Trump would mean for the rest of the world, you know. There is a great degree of global uncertainty. It's coming in the backdrop of two live conflicts. But the question is, will Donald Trump really try and push end of wars as he ensured during his first 4 years? We saw him also push the Abraham Accords.
I think if we learned anything from Trump's first 4 years in office, and I've seen nothing during his campaign or the last 4 years to contradict this, it's that he is mercurial. He can be quite erratic. And so unpredictability really in some ways is going to be the name of the game. Now, there are certain things that are consistent about his administration. He loves tariffs. He is a protectionist, and he has some isolationist tendencies. So in that sense, I would expect to see the United States retreat in some ways from other parts of the world, to put up trade barriers, to become less involved in sending weapons to, say, Ukraine or to other countries. But that's not uniform. He was heavily involved in the Middle East. He conducted a very risky strike that wound up in order to kill specifically a senior Iranian general. So I don't think we can quite say exactly what the effect is going to be. It's going to cut in multiple directions. Again, I would expect some protectionism, but a great degree of unpredictability.
On the economic front, Ishan Tharoor, what are your thoughts? Do you think America will be engaging with the world strategically and economically as well?
Well, we have to work with what President-elect Trump has said on the campaign trail, and he has vowed to slap a lot of tariffs on a lot of goods from a lot of places and take certain protectionist steps that, if fully enacted, would really take the global economy into uncharted territory. You'd mm-hmm. see retaliatory measures from other governments. You would see the kind of acceleration of the unraveling of globalization to a certain extent. So there is a lot of uncertainty surrounding what Trump may or may not do on this front, and a lot of anxiety because it could have extreme consequences across the board and not just in the United States. That said, you know, we should also recognize that we're in very early stages right now. The Trump transition team is still figuring out, you know, what sort of figures are going to be in these positions to enact the policies of this nationalist Trump presidency, but what we do know is that, unlike the first term, in this second term, Trump has fewer checks on him. He has more loyalists in Congress. He has a perceived mandate to really push through aggressive reforms. He wants to radically revamp the federal bureaucracy. So you know, he's going to come in quite emboldened and take a lot of steps that could be quite disruptive.
Ishan, a word also on the worry, potential worry, is that there could be a rise of protectionism and decreased global cooperation.
Well, you know, President Trump has made no bones about the fact that he is suspicious of certain multilateral systems and institutions, much prefers bilateral deal making, is interested in making these deals in many ways, in many fronts, is transactional in his view of the world, less tethered to kind of the values-based approach of previous American administrations. And yes, for America's traditional allies and also for partners in Asia, there is a great deal of anxiety. I would not necessarily say fear, but unease about what may happen, largely, as Daniel said, because it's quite unpredictable. And we don't know when President Trump may pull certain levers, what approaches he may actually take, and also what voices within his camp, which is not a monolith, he may listen to on certain policy fronts.
Okay. Is there that sense of anxiety also in Ukraine, Michael?
To be with you, you know, it's kind of surprising here because people, when you ask them, what's your opinion, whether it would be better with Biden or Trump, they kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, it doesn't matter who's in power as long as the war is ended. But I think what people are really looking for here, as well as leaders of Poland and other surrounding countries, are a show of strength, because that is something autocrats like Mr. Putin only understands, this drip feed approach to giving little bits of aid to Ukraine over time has just not worked. Neither have the sanctions worked that well either. So if Trump is going to come in, a lot of people here hope, and really push Mr. Putin back, that will make a big, big difference in this war. But I can tell you, over the past 48 hours, the violence here has actually gotten worse. That's why I was late joining you, is because there's another air raid siren and more drones and missiles headed to Ukraine. It doesn't look like, if Mr. Putin was afraid of Mr. Trump, that he would act in this way. So a lot of uncertainty still in the air, but I can tell you, everyone really is hoping for an end to the violence here, because it's very much, you know, dividing communities,
absolutely,
hurting families, destroying the economy, and lots of death and injuries, obviously.
Absolutely. Pastor, come in on this. You know, the new avatar of Donald Trump, what will it be? Because as I said, and you heard from most guests on the show, there is a great degree of uncertainty given, you know, the nature of the president.
Well, I mean, you got to look at the first term, and that should tell you a lot what how the second term would be, but even greater. Remember, the uncertainty that they had on the first term was that Donald Trump was going to start World War III with North Korea. Donald Trump was going to start all these wars. Donald Trump is unhinged. Donald Trump is unpredictable. So these same terminologies was used before his first term. And yet America had the greatest economy that we've had in the last 50 years. I mean, America, President Trump never started no war. He actually prevented escalations, de-escalations of wars. Again, Ukraine and Russia would not be happening had Donald Trump won the second term in 2020. So, again, we look at what he did the first time. Now we know the type of president he's going to be the second time, which is a stronger America is a stronger world. And if people are concerned about how things are happening around the world, trust me, President Trump would do what he did to other Taliban leaders and other enemies of the United States of America in our interest. He would start sending pictures of their houses and reminding them that we know where you live at, to cease fire immediately and bring peace to where it needs to be. And I believe this conflict in Ukraine and Russia will come to an end quickly, because there are millions of people that are unsafe, and it's happening on both sides. People are dying, especially in Ukraine. Innocent people are dying in Ukraine. Trust me, I believe, because I know the man, those wars will be put to a stop immediately.
Okay. Michael, is that there a thought on the ground that had Donald Trump got a second term, then this war wouldn't have happened at all?
With all due respect to the previous speaker, no, absolutely not. Because Mr. Putin doesn't care what other world leaders think. And, you know, it took a while, actually, for Mr. Trump to decide to give those Javelin missiles to Ukraine. And when they were given with very strict restrictions. And also the sanctions hardly went far enough. So I hope that Mr. Trump sees and realizes and listens to European leaders that, again, the only thing Mr. Putin realizes is brutal strength. So what that means, for example, is giving Ukraine the capability to use those Western-supplied missiles to strike deeper inside Russia, where the drones and rockets are coming from, and also to provide Ukraine with more air defense systems. And if I can, I would also add that the way for Mr. Trump to spin this to the electorate, who admittedly, I think, is more concerned about the American economy, immigration, things like this, if this war isn't stopped, Mr. Putin will go further and constrain food coming out of the Black Sea ports of Ukraine, and he will also further mess up the situation in the Red Sea, where Russia is providing Houthi rebels with targeting information to strike ships there. So he needs to explain to the American people, and Biden did not do this well, that if the war isn't stopped, it'll hurt Americans' pocketbooks, and it could also trigger another flow of asylum seekers to the West.
Okay. Lakshya, is there a sense of uncertainty also among the diaspora? Not many members of the diaspora were actually, you know, rooting for Trump. They were of the opinion that given the nature of the immigration policy and some tough words that the former president had spoken on the campaign trail, a Democrat continuity was in their best interest.
Yeah, well, it's important to remember that Indian Americans have generally been a Democratic-leaning group, and especially with Vice President Kamala Harris being half of Indian origin, right, from her mother especially, it's pretty important to know that, like, there was a pretty high level of support regardless for Kamala Harris. So the Indian American community in the United States was much more inclined to support her. So there is obviously, when your candidate loses a race, when the candidate that you support loses a race, there's obviously going to be a lot of uncertainty and unease, especially considering Indian Americans have never voted for Donald Trump. Now, how that translates into policy will remain to be seen, but it is worth noting that, yes, this time around, Indian Americans really did seem to shift hard to Kamala Harris in polling, and assuming that's validated, there will be a little bit of uncertainty about what comes next.
Okay. Daniel, in this era of uncertainty, perhaps we'll have to wait till 20th. Of early next year when the inauguration of the presidency would happen. But, you know, given the nature of the governance which is taking shape, the choice of the head of staff, is there some indication that you're getting?
I still think it's too early to say. I would echo what Ishan said earlier. We need to see who is going to staff more of the jobs. The chief of staff choice is interesting insofar as it was one of his campaign co-chairs, and she's somebody who clearly ran an effective campaign insofar as he won. But we do know that even that campaign was marked by a degree of turbulence. There were power struggles between the co-chairs and Corey Lewandowski, who ran most of his 2016 campaign. There were periods where they were able to, in some ways, it seems, rein Trump in and prevent him from doing things they saw as electorally damaging. There were others where they weren't, and he went out and he caused controversies. In the end, it didn't matter. He won. But again, we do see this kind of unpredictability taking place. In terms of what I expect him to do, the main things I see taking shape right now, the main thing that seems to be talked about on Capitol Hill and in Washington is expanding or at least extending the tax cuts he passed in his first term. That seems like the big first legislative agenda item that's going to take place. But I also do expect to see, like some of the other guests have saying, tariffs. I do expect to see perhaps less support for Ukraine. And I do expect to see at least some restrictive immigration policies. Whether he'll go as far as he said he would, we'll see. It will depend on who the advisors are. It will depend on how much money he can get from Congress to pursue some of his restrictive policies. But I do expect extensive tax cuts. That's one of the things I think we can certainly expect to see happen.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael, Pastor Mark Burns, Ishan Tharoor, Daniel Block, and Lakshya Jain. Let me go straight to Kenny Chiu now, who is former Conservative MP of Canada. Thank you so much for your patience. There are There is this view that Donald Trump becoming president of the United States will increase the pace of what is being seen as imperative that Justin Trudeau will be resigning as the Prime Minister of Canada. Of course, this is as per certain pieces that are being written by those who are in Canada. How do you really see this, and what exactly does it mean? And we are seeing that there are several aspects of it which are still taking shape.
Well, knowing Justin Trudeau, I think that he is looking at Donald Trump's re-election as the 47th president as a godsend for him. You may find that inconsistent or contradictory, but Justin Trudeau see that he would be able to use an overt anti-American sentiment in particularly the liberal side and the left of center voter side as a way to smear and beat up the conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. He's going to compare Donald Trump with Pierre Poilievre. The irony is that unlike Justin Trudeau, Pierre Poilievre grew out of an adopted family, a middle-class teacher, and he grew up not in abundance and trust funds, but in a small, accountable family. And he married a Venezuela refugee immigrant as wife. So one can argue that Donald Trump has more in common with Justin Trudeau than Pierre Poilievre. But on the other hand, Justin Trudeau has been fooling the Canadian people for many years now. From my perspective, in my opinion, I think he's counting the election of Donald Trump as the lucky star. He's going to use Donald Trump to hit hard on the conservative, comparing Pierre Poilievre to Donald Trump, comparing the conservatives as the Republicans. So, you know, this actually has already happened. Canada, it's a progressive country. For example, abortion, it's not prohibited or even regulated. And he keep on saying that Pierre Poilievre, the conservatives, they're going to ban abortion. They're going to, allow assault rifles and all these crazy ideas that he drum up with and smear his opposition. And so you may not believe, but Justin Trudeau is actually counting his lucky star that Donald Trump is the president.
Okay, that's an interesting analysis there. But Mr. Kenny, what about the future of this war? The war which has all the NATO nations back it, so with all the weapons and all the support that Zelensky has got so far.
Well, ultimately, I think Donald Trump is a businessman. I wouldn't take his rhetoric literally and for face value. I would argue that the Ukrainians, what they are suffering right now, and the fact that the invader Russians, the defeating of the Russian invaders would align quite well with American interest. And so I think in the end, Donald Trump would look at the bigger picture and realize that to help the Ukrainians defeat Russia would actually align very well with what he'd like to see happen in Europe. But on the other hand, though, for a long time, the Americans' allies in Europe and even Canada has been taking advantage of the U.S. of A. And we in Canada here, we like to criticize the American, doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or the Republican presidents. We make fun of them. We criticize their healthcare system. But on the other hand, we don't live up to the responsibility of protecting ourselves vis-a-vis with the defense budget, for example, that I highlighted earlier. So I think what Donald Trump had done, at least the first term of Donald Trump had done, is to shake the tree a little bit and to tell these allies who traditionally been taking advantage of the Americans for their protection, doesn't matter if it's France or Germany or Canada, you know, they understand, like the Americans, Donald Trump, the administration, they understand that. That's why even in Donald Trump 1.0, he already had sent out a very clear message that everybody has their responsibility. In Korea, for example, in South Korea, and also in Japan. Had it not been the Donald Trump 1.0, you know, in the 45th presidency, they would not have increased their budget for you know, so dramatically, and they would not be like today ready to face the challenges from North Korea or China. The fact that South Korea and Japan was able to handle that now, it's because of Donald Trump's giving them the ultimatum. Similarly, I think there is much room for European countries to be standing up, just like Canada. I would agree that we need to stand up and protect our northern border against Russians and also a very ambitious Chinese. And unfortunately, the current government has not been doing it, and it is up to the next government to do it.
Kenneth, you really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me go straight to Washington, D.C., where Lisa Curtis is joining us. She's the director of the Indo-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Ma'am, thank you so much for Screen 20 TV. How do you think the election result will influence the bipartisan cooperation in Congress, particularly on issues of security and foreign policy?
Well, we see that the Republicans are now holding the majority in the Senate, and we don't know the results of the House race yet and whether the Republicans will continue to hold the House. So we need to see what happens there. But I think the fact that the Republicans will control the Senate will make confirmations of political appointees, you know, cabinet level positions and some of the other sub-cabinet level positions that require confirmation. I think those will go more smoothly, and President-elect Trump will be able to put the people who he wants in these positions, and it should move fairly quickly. So this is a good thing for foreign policy, national security. This is good for continuity in U.S. policy. So I think that's one thing that we're likely to see. So, you know, I think the Congress does have influence on foreign policy and national security issues. Obviously, they pass legislation, they control the budgets. So they'll continue to play a strong role. But I think it will be much easier for President Trump, at least, you know, on the Senate side, to be able to push those initiatives that he wants to push through. So we'll wait and see what happens on the House side. You know, clearly, if the Republicans also take the House, then that gives tremendous power for the Republicans to push forward on their agenda. And we could see some really, you know, groundbreaking initiatives, historical initiatives happening in that case. Okay. But we still have to wait. We haven't seen the final result in the House of Representatives.
Certainly.
Quite yet.
Ms. Curtis, in the first term, Donald Trump's policy sought to append the global order as United States adopted an inward-looking and transactional approach. Do you think that is going to change in the new presidency?
Well, look, you know, Trump has 4 years of being president under his belt. He's learned a lot. I think one of the things that he has learned is to really be careful about his picks, you know, who he's going to pick to be in his cabinet. I think he has expressed that he may have made some mistakes initially in 2017. He's not going to repeat those mistakes. So, you know, that's the first order of business. I think he'll still focus on, you know, hard bargains, trade deals that benefit the American people, that protect U.S. manufacturing, protect U.S. jobs. That will still be a major focus of his. But I also think that he really relishes this idea of him being able to use his negotiating skills in helping to, you know, calm conflicts or even, you know, resolve conflicts throughout the globe. So I would expect him to, you know, put a lot of attention and resources into trying to, you know, end the war in between Russia and Ukraine, as well as even in the Middle East. I think he recognizes that the world is very unsteady right now with all of these global conflicts happening. And I think he believes he has something to bring to the table, which is his negotiating skills and his ability to, you know, work with all sides to try to calm these conflicts down. And I think he believes he has a major mandate from the U.S. public to do that. Part of the reason I think people have voted for Trump is because they did feel the world was very insecure, very unstable, and that he could somehow be able to bring, you know, strength and peace through strength is what I think people are looking for. So let's see. I think we may see more of, you know, Trump the peacemaker coming through in this next term.
Okay, you know, you have made a prediction which is going to be, which is being seen, which will be seen as very fantastic in the sense that Trump the peacemaker. So let's talk about that, Ms. Curtis. The fact is, the end of the Second World War and the Cold War, United States had shepherded the world order through its military might and also set rules for global order, global trade order and commerce. When you say he will play the role of peacemaker, what will it really be? Will he be putting more pressure on NATO? How will he really operate?
Well, I think what I'm saying is, you know, there is very much this idea of peace through strength. So he will continue to build up the U.S. military, you know, ensure we're working closely with allies and partners and ensure that the U.S. has, you know, the latest in, you know, military innovation and equipment and resources. But at the same time, I think he will try to use his leadership, his negotiating skills to try to calm the conflicts that are happening throughout the world. And, you know, at the top of the list would be the Russia-Ukraine war. Now, he has said he'll try to end that in 24 hours. I don't think that's possible. But, you know, I think he will try to do what he can. But the important thing is that, you know, if this conflict is ended, it has to be done in a way that Russia, you know, never again feels emboldened to try to illegally and unjustly take the territory of another country, which is exactly what it's doing in Ukraine right now. So I think, you know, the way that conflict ends is very important to, you know, maintaining U.S. credibility and U.S. global leadership. And that's one of the things that will have to be really thought through, because it's going to be complicated. It's going to be difficult. And it really has to be done in a way that does not lead to the emboldening of other U.S. adversaries throughout the world, that they think they can also, you know, unjustly take the territory of a sovereign nation. So I think, you know, these are all important things. They're very complicated. But I think, you know, this is something that Trump has indicated he wants to focus on.
Yes. And do you think, Ms. Curtis, that this will be a completely different Donald Trump in his second presidency, someone who's chasing legacy, because he has been in White House, he would be in White House for a second term? It will be about how he redefines his presidency.
Well, I think it's really early to say. Like I said, you know, he's learned a lot from being president already. He campaigned very hard. He fought very hard for, you know, each and every vote that he got. So I think, you know, he wants to, you know, do what he can for the American people. His number one priority will be the economy and, you know, strengthening the U.S. economy, making sure Americans have jobs, doing what he can to bring down inflation, lower gas prices. You know, he's also been very clear that he wants to, you know, invest in U.S. energy production and increase U.S. energy exports. I think, you know, rest assured he's going to be focusing on that. So I think, you know, his number one priority will, of course, be the economy and building up the economy, as well as fulfilling his pledges on immigration. He's talked about, you know, reducing illegal immigration into the United States, even possibly deporting illegal immigrants. We've yet to see how he's going to carry that out. But, you know, I think we can see his priorities. You know, he's been very clear about what his priorities will be. And this is what we can expect to see.
Okay, my last question to you. Will it be America engaging differently with the rest of the world? Because the Chinese think that Trump 2.0 will usher in a post-American world order.
Well, that is, you know, quite a claim right there. And I think that, you know, again, you know, the American people have spoken. What their vote means is that they want to see a stronger economy. They want to see, you know, a safer United States. They, you know, are feeling insecure about what's happening throughout the world. So that's really the mandate that I think President Trump has. And in terms of a new order, I'm not quite sure what that official was referring to. But I think that, you know, we basically, you know, have a democracy. The people have spoken. And, you know, these are the kinds of changes that I think we're going to see is more focused on the domestic economy. But, you know, I would just like to indicate that there's a lot more continuity in U.S. foreign policy than I think people realize. Let's look at U.S. policy toward China, for example. You know, in the Trump administration toward the end, the Trump administration, you know, started putting export controls on technology to China. The U.S. started, you know, strengthening its position on China when it comes to things like 5G technology and, you know, warning of some of the dangers of relying on Chinese 5G technology. The Biden administration came in, they continued the export controls. They even went further and put export controls on semiconductor technology going to China. They kept the tariffs. The Biden administration kept the Trump tariffs and, you know, continued to carry forward initiatives like the Quad. And so I think we're going to see more continuity than change when it comes to policies toward China, toward the Indo-Pacific. So I'm not sure that, you know, we can expect much difference when it comes to at least the China and Indo-Pacific policies.
All right, Lisa Curtis, thank you so much for joining us on The Big Fight tonight and sharing your views. On that note, we are slipping into a short break. Coming up would be someone who has been part of Donald Trump's campaign and knows him through and through. So what are his predictions of Donald Trump's next presidency? We'll try and get details. Stay with us. Sebastian. Watching Big Fight, and I'm going to go straight to Washington, D.C., where Sebastian Gorka is joining us. He is former Deputy Assistant to the President of the United States. Mr. Gorka, I appreciate your time. Many pollsters had predicted it to be a close contest, and results are certainly unexpected. But as someone who closely watched it, was involved in the campaign, what do you think are the factors that worked for President Trump?
on top of that, the disastrous state of the economy, the inflation, the price of petrol, the fact that when we were in the White House, the average monthly payment for a house mortgage was $800. Under the Harris-Biden administration, the average mortgage payment is more than twice that. It is $1,700. Maybe the fact that Kamala Harris, the border czar, let more than 20 million illegals into this country, many of whom are criminals and who have taken over cities like Aurora, Colorado. And I think the most important thing of all is people who love America don't like being called garbage by the incumbent president, Joe Biden. They don't like being called fascists, as Kamala did. And they've had it with left-wing radical extremism that is today's Democrat Party. But the list, I could go on and on and on. The list is a very long one.
Absolutely. Dr. Gourka, the world has been certainly taken by surprise by what will be at the moment seen as total dominance of Republicans. Do you think then the new administration will be focusing on the bread and butter issues like what Donald Trump promised during his campaign, or will it? Because, you know, during his victory speech, Donald Trump did sound very, very conciliatory. He was sounding and spoke about being this healer.
It's about saving the country. This isn't about feel-good moments. It's about saving the country and stabilizing the world. I mean, think about it. When we were in the White House, when President Trump was the commander-in-chief, there were no new wars. China was behaving herself. Russia wasn't invading her neighbors. The Iranian proxies weren't murdering hundreds of Jews. The world was on fire for the last 4 years. So it's about everything. It's about bread and butter issues, geopolitics. It's about stopping the invasion of illegal aliens across our borders. It's about doing what the president promised he would do, exactly as he did in the first 4 years, that it's time to take America back. It's time to stop the insanity. I mean, the idea, for example, that you had Kamala Harris talk about, you know, transgender surgery paid by taxpayers for prisoners. This just, I mean, they're insane. They're a party of lunatics. It's about everything. It's about protecting our country. It's about implementing our national interests. It's about preventing World War III. I mean, we were on the cusp of World War III for the last 3 years because of the sheer rank incompetence of the Harris-Biden administration. So to answer your question, it's all of the above.
Okay, do you foresee any opportunities for bipartisan cooperation under Trump's presidency? Or will this partisan divide persist?
There will be no bipartisanship. I mean, listen to what the Democrats have been saying for the last 3 days. The chief architect of the theft of the 2020 election, Mark Elias, is holding a war council next week for the whole week with dozens of radical organizations to initiate a new lawfare campaign against President Trump to prevent him from exercising the mandate given to him by the American people. This is being reported in the mainstream media. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that darling of the Democrats in Congress, just released a video yesterday about the fascist threat of President Trump. They're doubling down. I mean, CNN had guests on their show yesterday saying, oh, yes, black men voted for Trump because they're misogynists, because they hate women like Kamala. I mean, these people have learned nothing from President Trump winning both the Electoral College and the popular vote on Tuesday night. As a result, there will be no bipartisanship from the left, because they're an anti-American lunatic cult you cannot work with. And thankfully, we will have enough seats in the Senate and likely the House that President Trump can actually execute the double mandate he has been given by the American people.
Yes, you have interestingly highlighted this double mandate. It's about popularity vote as much as the Electoral College. But how do you think Donald Trump's victory affect U.S. relations with international partners and adversaries, particularly in regions like the Middle East and Asia?
It'll be exactly what we did when we were in the White House the first time. I stole a phrase from the Marine Corps, where I'd been teaching for several years before I came into the White House, to explain what President Trump is doing and will do again. And the phrase is, under Trump administration, America, no better friend, no worse enemy. If you're a bad guy, if you're evil, like Xi, like Putin, like the Mullahs, things are not going to be good for you for the next 4 years. If you're a friend of America, if you're Israel, if you're the UK, if you're India, you're going to have your friend supporting you again, and you will be safe. It's really that simple.
Okay. Dr. Gorka, in terms of policy areas, do you think Donald Trump will prioritize in the second term, and how will it really... will he be going all out to address the pressing issues like the economy, inflation?
Well, he's going to bring in incredible geniuses like Elon Musk to slash the size of this gargantuan bloated government. So the man who's revitalized car manufacturing, space travel, truly a genius level entrepreneur, that man will be given a portfolio to get government off the back of the average American. So that's where it's going to begin. We're going to seal the border on day one. The president is going to drill, baby, drill. He's going to release that liquid gold, as he calls it, under our feet, because energy is the lifeblood of any economy. So none of this stuff, I mean, you don't have to ask me. And just listen to his speeches. I think he did 250 rallies in this year. And he's told us exactly what he's going to do. He's going to unleash the American economy, shrink the size of government, rebuild our armed forces, secure the border, ban the lunacy of transgenderism, and protect Americans so we can prosper and thrive again. He's done it before. He's going to do it again.
Okay. My last question to you. Among the many historic firsts about in this victory is that he's also the oldest president to win White House. How do you see age as a factor?
It isn't. Anybody who brings this up is stupid. I mean, this is the mainstream media's idiocy. Age isn't a function. I know very, very, very young 90-year-olds. I know 60-year-olds who are decrepit and mentally not there. I am 25 years younger than my former boss. I can't keep up with him. This is a man who would do 4 or 5 rallies in one day. When I was in the White House and the president was tweeting at 3 a.m., I was asked frequently, hey, that's you, Seb, right? You're writing those tweets for the president. And I said, no, I need my sleep. This man is unique. The genetics of Donald Trump, our new president, our former president, our future president, I mean, God broke the mold when they made Donald Trump, because he's a force of nature. I mean, his last rally before the election, it was his 4th rally or 5th rally in the day, and he finished it at 2 a.m. when I was with him in Mar-a-Lago for the election night watch party. He hadn't slept for 3 days straight. So if anybody brings up age, they're cretins, they're clinical imbeciles. This man is indefatigable.
All right, Sebastian Gorka, pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of The Big Fight. That's all from me. I'll be seeing you next week with another episode of The Big Fight, and that will be from Battleground Maharashtra. Stay with us.